because it all mattered, she said. You had to feel it, to understand it in every way you could, to get inside of it. And the thing might take over. It might try to rule your life, but it was your case to solve. She found a 1930s online station and shoved in her earbuds. The morning was apple crisp. The air cleaned the body from the inside, scraping out the lungs, pumping cold life into the arteries. Not veins. Veins returned deoxygenated blood to the heart. The arteries were carrying this, swinging up the arch of the aorta, shooting up the carotid, giving her brain all the delicious oxygen candy it wanted. She turned on the music, and a low, swinging sound pumped into her ears. She walked in time with it, letting her foot hit the stones of the path with each beat. Become it. Tune into it. Go back in time through the air, the rhythm. She would walk the campus once. She would start by going between the houses, wandering through the streets and the snaking pathways. She found herself moving gracefully, straightening her back. If she saw anyone in the distance, she changed her path, moving gently around a tree, turning a corner. The rumor was that Albert Ellingham had designed his pathways by following a cat that was walking the grounds because cats know best. It probably wasn't true, but you never knew with Albert Ellingham. As she walked her new musical path, Stevie suddenly had the realization of how right this statement could be. Cats do know best, in many ways. They are hunters, good at tracking, remaining unseen. They can move from the slinking shadows up to the heights and down again. Cats see all the levels, where people generally look straight in front of them. Who was here? Edward and Frankie, with their gangster cosplay. They had become truly devious. But why? Just to play a game back at the Game Master? They looked rich. Two rich, bored kids, wanting to be bad. Sort of like a rich boy she knew who had gone and gotten his face punched to gravy last night for no reason she could fathom, except making his father notice him. Today wasn't about David, but the connection made sense. She would use it. Edward and Frankie were acting something out that only they understood. So they sent a letter. But they didn't get a car and take Iris and Alice, did they? They would have been noticed, surely. And where would they have put Alice? They weren't the large man out on the dome that night. They didn't beat up George Marsh or get a boat to collect a ransom on Lake Champlain. There was no internet then and barely any phones. You don't coordinate something like that when you have basically nothing to work with. So it was a coincidence, maybe. Or someone used that letter, folded it into the plot. And what about Dottie? Stevie was walking across the base of the green now, past the statues of the Sphinx. Dottie understood myth. She would have known all about the riddle of the Sphinx. She read constantly. Stevie stopped and looked at the great house from this, the farthest point you could survey it on the campus. The music had changed to an up-tempo jazz song. This is the kind of music that would have played that weekend before the kidnapping, when the party was going on in the house. The house, the heart of this place, beating with life and song. What had Fenton told her about the last thing Albert Ellingham said to Mackenzie? It was on the wire. Wire? Wireless? Had he heard something on the radio? Was it meaningless? He was just going out for a boat ride. He had no idea he was going to die. He could have been talking about anything. But he had been updating his will. The codicil that had long been rumored, what if that was real? What if he had put together a fortune for anyone who could produce his daughter, dead or alive? What if he knew something was about to happen to him? He wrote a riddle. He finalized his business, and he told Mackenzie it was on the wire. Stevie once went to one of those sushi places where the food comes by on a little conveyor belt. That's what her mind felt like sometimes. Facts floating by on a little track. Sometimes she'd have the urge to reach for one, pick it up, feast on it. The wire. The wire, she said out loud. She walked toward the house. It seemed to swell as she approached it. The Neptune fountain was switched off for the season, leaving the god of the sea to regard her from his dry perch. There was someone in Larry's place by the front door, a younger guy with a uniform from a security company, the same one Edward King had hired to install the cameras. He stopped her as she tried to walk in, but "Call me Charles" called out from the balcony above.
"Stevie, could you come up a second?"
Stevie continued up the steps, passing the Ellingham family portrait. Charles was standing on the landing with Jenny Quinn.
"Have you seen David Eastman by any chance?"
"Yesterday," she said, "in Burlington."
"Since then?"
She shook her head. Jenny looked to Charles as if to say, "See?"
"Has he called you, or—"
"No," she said. "Sorry." There was no point in telling him that David said he wasn't coming back. This was not her circus, and he was not her clown on the loose. All of that business would come crashing down on its own. No need to rush it.
"All right," he said. "Thanks. You going up to the attic?"
Stevie nodded.
"If he happens to call you, would you tell us?"
"You saw the video,"
Jenny said. It wasn't a question. "I'll let you know if I hear from him," Stevie said, continuing up and then heading to the back staircase that led to the attic. Stevie usually noodled around when she first got up here, letting herself have a look around, peering into boxes, pulling things from shelves. Not today. There was one thing she had come here for, and she had to find it. It was in the boxes that contained objects from Albert Ellingham's office. The dust and smell of old paper itched the inside of her nose. So many things from Albert Ellingham's office. Thumbtacks, petrified rolls of tape that had turned amber with age, yellowed, unused notepads with his name embossed on them, scissors, paperweights, letter openers, dried up pots of ink. And a bunch of spools in maroon and white with the words "Webster Chicago" written on them. Next to that, on a scrap of paper taped down with yellowed tape, were the letters DE. She dug down farther, pulling something from the bottom of the box that had been meaningless. It was a cardboard box, the packaging for the spools. She could tell because there was a picture of one drawn on the package. It read, "Webster Chicago Recording Wire."
"Recording wire," she said out loud.
"Recording wire."
If this was a recording, the question was, what the hell would play it? If you had tapes, clearly something made them. Stevie spun around in the tight confines of the aisle. The music changed again, and so did Stevie's thinking. Albert Ellingham had handily made her a guide of things in his house and where they were, and he did it in the form of a giant dollhouse. Stevie hurried to the other end of the attic, pulled off the cover, and carefully opened the dollhouse. She squatted down in front of Albert Ellingham's tiny office, feeling like a giant looking down on this great man's life. There were so many recognizable things in there. Some had moved around a bit, but surprisingly, little had changed in terms of placement and decor. There were the leather chairs, the trophy rugs, the two desks covered in tiny papers and telephones no bigger than Stevie's thumbnail. The bookshelves were full of impossibly small volumes. There was the globe, the green marble clock on the mantel, and a cabinet with a weird little object on it about the size of a computer printer. Well, this thing was about the size of a matchbox, but it represented something the size of a printer. She reached down and pinched the thing up. It could have been a radio, but it had words printed on it with what must have been a fine brush. Webster, Chicago. The device. She had the little thing for reference, and now she had to find the big one. The Ellinghams had so much stuff, hundreds and thousands of things, but nothing mattered right now except this thing. She worked methodically, starting on the first shelf that contained office materials. She pulled down one after another, sneezing into documents, hauling down old phone directories, staining her fingertips with dust and muck. She climbed the metal shelving when it was high, not really testing to see if it could hold her. The thing had to be found. It took almost 2 hours.
It was in a large cardboard box under a box heavy with records. The machine weighed perhaps 30 pounds. It was silver and maroon, very sleek and art deco, the words Webster Chicago still with a bit of a gleam. She looked at the thick old cords, the spools, the dials. She wasn't even sure if it was safe to plug in or how to make it work. Luckily, she knew a genius. 23.
Okay, Janelle said, fastening her tool belt. Let's have a look at this thing.
The ancient recorder sat on a cart in the middle of the maintenance shed. Janelle had a look of pure happiness on her face and a pair of goggles resting on her head. The one nice thing about the new security setup was that Larry was not there to question the fact that Stevie needed this dusty hunk of garbage from the attic. She said she had been told to bring it over to the maintenance shed to be cleaned up, and the person at the desk nodded. She lugged it over where Janelle, Nate, and Vi were waiting. There was nothing like an all-caps text that said, "I need you to fix a machine," to get Janelle's attention. Janelle began by wiping the outside of the machine down delicately with a cloth. Then she undid the latch, revealing the four spools of the old mechanism. She got down low to examine the machine, walking around it, peering into the top. Then she closed the box and turned it over.
"This casing has to come off," she said, going over to a wall of tools and picking up a cordless drill that sat in a charger.
Nate was cross-legged on the floor, looking at his phone. Vi was sitting on a pile of wood, gazing at their girlfriend with an undisguised, "You look hot with your tools, look." Stevie fidgeted, sometimes leaning against the wall or sitting next to Nate or walking to the door. More than once she crossed the room to where the dry ice container had been, the one that had contained the substance that caused Hayes's death. It had been taken away, possibly for good or maybe stashed somewhere else. A few loose rakes and shovels leaned against the wall in the spot. There was the quick bzzz of the drill as Janelle took out the screws that held the casing.
"It's going to snow in a few days," Nate said, looking up from his phone. "A lot. Some kind of monster blizzard is coming."
"Oh, good,"
Janelle said, setting the drill down on the floor.
"I love snow. That is amazing up here."
"Do you like a lot of snow?"
Nate asked.
"Yes, but define a lot. I'm from Chicago. It snows there."
3 feet, possibly more with drifts."
"That is a lot of snow," Janelle said approvingly. "You probably don't like snow, right?"
"Oh, I like it,"
Nate said.
"Snow makes it socially acceptable to stay in."
Janelle's laugh rang from one end of the workshop to the other as she carefully turned the machine over and lifted off the casing, revealing the naked mechanism underneath. It was a gray and brown mess of spools and wires and grungy metal places.
"Pretty girl," Janelle said. "Dirty girl. First thing, she needs a cleaning." "You think you can get it to work?" "You gotta have a little patience," Janelle said, lowering the goggles over her eyes. "I have to do my thing. I'm going to blast it with some air and clean it out."
She retrieved something that looked like a clunky toy gun with a slender hummingbird beak of a barrel. She poked it into the machine and began shooting air into it, releasing little puffs of dust and debris.
"Okay,"
Janelle said, pushing the goggles back and stuffing the air gun into her belt.
"This looks like it's been preserved pretty well. I think what I need to do is switch out these capacitors and maybe wire on a new power cord. I have capacitors in my supply box, and I'll find a cord and strip it down, wire it in."
This was all having an effect on Vi, whose eyes had almost turned to heart shapes.
"Love is in the air," Nate said quietly. "Love may be on top of your machine in a minute."
After about an hour of work, Janelle replaced the casing on the machine.
"Okay," she said. "Let's see how this goes."
She turned one of the dials and the reels began to spin. Stevie and Nate jumped from their places on the floor.
"You did it," Stevie said. "Seriously?"
"Of course I did it," Janelle said, reaching into her bra and producing a lip gloss, which she applied without looking. I'm the queen of the machine.
Vi wrapped themselves around Janelle.
Okay, Stevie said, handing over the wire. How does this work?
Yeah, I was looking that up,
Vi said, detaching themselves from Janelle.
People collect these. Lots of tutorials. This is the best one I could find.
They passed their phone over to Janelle, who watched a video. She picked up the wire and spooled it, consulting with the video a few times.
I think that's it, she said. I don't want to record over it. I think that's it. Want to try it?
Stevie nodded and Janelle flipped the switch. The wire turned on the spools. For a moment, there was only a crackling and hissing noise, then a few muffled booms, as if something was hitting a microphone. And then, a voice. Deep, male. Albert Ellingham, unmistakably.
Dolores, sit there.
Sit here?
A girl's voice. Dolores Epstein, speaking. Stevie reeled in shock. Dolores was a character, a person from the past, lost. Here she was now, among them, her voice high and clear, with a very thick New York accent.
Just there, and lean into the microphone a bit,
Albert Ellingham said. Janelle looked to Stevie with wide, excited eyes.
Good,
he said.
Now all you have to do is speak normally. I want to ask you a bit about your experiences at Ellingham. I'm making some recordings about the school so people know what kind of work we do up here. Now, Dolores, before I met you, you got into all sorts of scrapes, didn't you?
Is this for the radio?
Dottie asked.
No, you can speak freely.
I like to look around, that's all, she said.
And that's a good thing. I was exactly the same way.
My uncle is a cop in New York. He says I'm like a second story man.
A second story man?
Albert Ellingham asked.
A second story man is a thief who, as the name suggests, enters through a second story window. Slightly more sophisticated than a snatch and grabber. But to be honest, it's my uncle who taught me how to get into places. Police officers know all the tricks. And I've always been interested in locks and things like that.
What did you think when you first came here? It must be very different from New York.
Well, I was frightened, honestly.
Of what?
I'm used to the city, not the woods. The woods are scary.
The woods are lovely.
And dark and deep, as the poet Robert Frost says. When I told my uncle I was coming here, he said it was all right because you have an attic man here.
An attic man?
He asked.
Another colloquialism. What's above the second story? The attic. My uncle always said cops who could get the drop on the second story men, that means catch them in the act, needed to be right above them. You have a policeman here from New York, Mr. Marsh. I felt better after that. I like it up here now.
Albert Ellingham chuckled.
I'm glad to hear it. And what would you tell the world about Ellingham Academy?
Well, I'd say it was the best place I've ever been. It takes elements of the system developed by Maria Montessori, although I see elements of the work of John Dewey, who is from here in Burlington, actually. Did you know that?
I did not. I learn something new every day here at the school. We learn from each other. Like I've also just learned about second story men. Now, let's talk about what you do every day here. Tell me about your studies.
Mudge's voice was suddenly in Stevie's head. They were looking at the cow's eye.
The one place where all the information goes in, you can't actually see anything.
There was a kind of flash behind Stevie's eyes. All the pieces that she had collected and seen over years of reading about this lined up in place. She wanted to move around a little, so she had to keep grabbing them, making sure they didn't move. She walked quickly to the door. She couldn't hear anything anymore, couldn't talk to anyone, or she would lose her grip on it.
Hey,
Janelle said, stopping the machine.
Where are you?
Stevie waved a hand. The sky had turned a candy-colored pink, and the air had a wet, frozen note to it. Good, clear air for thinking. That's the reason Albert Ellingham had bought this place to begin with. He thought the air was conducive to learning and thinking.
Maybe he was right. Once you get used to having a little less oxygen, everything seemed to move a bit faster. Think, Stevie. What was the thing she was missing? What had she seen? The Ellingham Library stood in stark relief against the pink sky, its spires dark. The library. Dottie left her mark in the library. Stevie broke out into a run. She blew through the door as Kyoko looked like she was ending her shift for the night. Stevie almost skidded up to her desk.
Kyoko, I need one thing. Can it wait until tomorrow?
Stevie shook her head.
The book, Dottie's book, the Sherlock Holmes. That can't wait? Please, she said. I'll be so quick. 5 minutes. 2 minutes.
Kyoko rolled her eyes a bit, but she reached down and got the keys and opened the back office. Stevie followed her along, past the metal shelving and the boxes, back down to the row where the treasures of 1936 were kept. She removed the sepia and white book from the box.
Be quick, but be careful, she said, passing it over.
Stevie accepted it like it was a holy object, carrying it over to one of the work tables.
What do you need this for in such a hurry? She said.
But Stevie could not hear her. She was busy looking for something she knew she had seen, something so small, a blip. There it was, in a study in scarlet. The mark in the book, one rough pencil line. Sherlock said, I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose. In A Study in Scarlet, a body is found with the word Rache written over it in blood. Rache, German for revenge. A victim-left sign of what had transpired.
Did you find what you were looking for?
Kyoko said, leaning over the table.
Yeah,
she said, getting up. She was almost stumbling now, catching her foot on the table leg in her haste.
Are you okay? Yeah, fine, definitely fine.
She hurriedly closed the book and passed it back to Kyoko, who placed it gently in a carrying crate.
Thanks, she said. I have to...
Thanks. Stevie hurried through the library, past people working at tables with their headphones on. Once outside, she gulped in air that was full of gentle flurries. They floated into her nose and melted on the back of her throat. She yanked her phone out of her pocket and called Fenton. Fenton's phone rang 5 times.
Come on, Stevie said, bouncing on her heels. Come on.
She paced along the path in front of the library.
Hello?
Fenton's voice was slurred and loud.
Hey, she said. I need to talk to you.
Can't right now, Stevie, she said.
No, you don't get it,
Stevie replied, trying not to yell.
Not now,
she said, her voice lowering to a hiss.
I will call you back in a bit. The kid is there. The kid is there.
What? She said. And with that, she was gone. Stevie stood with the phone still pressed to her ear, the glass surface getting cold and fogging with her breath. She stepped along the stone path. Sounds echoed louder in the cold. Each footfall was crisp and distinct. How could Fenton just hang up on her? How was she alone in the dark of this mountain, with no one to share these little threads of her thoughts that were being woven together by the little mice in her brain? How did she explain that she knew who kidnapped Alice and Iris Ellingham? October 30th, 1938, 5 p.m. It was an idyllic scene. Albert Ellingham's sporty little Sparkman and Stevens Day Sailor, Wonderland, idling on the waters of Lake Champlain. It had one red sail and one white, both stiffly at attention, though the boat was drifting ever so gently. The fine October afternoon in Vermont was oversaturated with color, like a paint box turned over on the landscape. Albert Ellingham kept one slack hand on the wheel. George Marsh sat on the padded seats that lined the boat, comfortably leaning back, his arms spread wide, enjoying the afternoon.
Do you read much, George?
Albert asked.
No,
George replied.
You should. Reading is one of the great pleasures of life. Maybe the greatest. You must never have had a Cuban cigar.
Albert Ellingham laughed.
It's true. All the money, all the power. None of it compares to a good book. A book gives you everything. It gives you a window into other souls, other worlds. The world is a door. Books are the key. You've lost me,
George said.
What about Sherlock Holmes? Ever read A Study in Scarlet? Surely you've read that one. Afraid not,
George said.
You should. You really should. It introduces Sherlock Holmes. It's a marvelous story, very instructive. You learn about how Sherlock Holmes sees the world and approaches his work. As someone in law enforcement, it would interest you. As a matter of fact, that story made me who I am. When I was a boy, growing up in the boys' home, we had only a few books. A collection of Sherlock Holmes was among them. I opened that book and read it, perhaps 100 times or more. It taught me to look, to see the world around me. It's one of the most instructive things ever written. All right.
George Marsh laughed and pulled out a cigarette.
You've convinced me. I'll get a library card. I've done my good deed for the day, then. Oh, and apologies, George. No smoking on the boat, if you don't mind. Fire and boats don't mix well.
George Marsh nodded and tucked the cigarette behind his ear.
I'm going to drop anchor here. We'll sit for a bit. I like it up here by Mequam Bay.
Albert Ellingham idly unwound a line from the rope spool and spun it around his hand, lowering the anchor into the water.
You know,
he said as he worked.
When they found Dottie Epstein, she was reading Sherlock Holmes. She's so often forgotten in all this. That's my fault. I focus on Iris, on Alice. Little Dottie Epstein from the Lower East Side gets swept aside in the shuffle. It's not right. She deserved better. That poor kid,
George Marsh said, shaking his head.
Dolores Epstein,
Albert Ellingham said.
Dottie, that's what she went by. Exceptional girl, truly exceptional. She was the first student I picked for the school. Did I ever tell you that?
George Marsh shook his head.
No?
Albert Ellingham said.
No, I suppose it never came up. I heard about her from one of the top librarians at the public library. This girl from Avenue A who read Greek and slipped into one of the rare books rooms 3 times. They said she was trouble, but good trouble. Good trouble. You understand me, George? I do,
George Marsh said.
There's some good trouble in you, if you don't mind my saying so. Not at all, not at all. I appreciate it. I went to her school, spoke with her principal. I could tell he was both happy to be rid of her and heartbroken at the same time. You don't get students like that every day. I remember the joy on her face when she arrived at the academy. When she went to my library and found out she could have any book she wanted. George, I'm a rich man. I own a lot. But I'll tell you something. The best money I ever spent was on Dottie Epstein's books. I was feeding a mind. She was a tremendous kid. What happened to her was terrible,
George Marsh said, nodding solemnly.
Beyond terrible. Beyond terrible. So much was lost that day. That mind of hers. And, you know, in the dome, when they found her, there was a copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. She had been reading it when it happened. So strange.
Albert Ellingham paused, pulling the rope tight around his fingers for a moment before tying it off. The boat spun gently and rocked in position.
You know,
Albert Ellingham said after a moment,
in that copy I saw she made a mark under a famous quote. I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic. I got to thinking about this line she underlined. It wasn't neat. It was scratched in pencil, rough, uneven. No other marks in the book. But who thinks about a mark in a student's book? And I was so caught up with Iris and Alice. I was looking, like Watson.
but I failed to observe.
But something must have lodged in my mind. You know how your mind works on a problem? It ticks away in the background. That mark under that line. It bothered me.
Albert Ellingham squinted a bit as the boat turned toward the setting sun.
I went over to the library and I had a look through the books Dottie Epstein had checked out. Not a mark on them, George. I confirmed this with the librarian. She checked for things like that. You don't get things past librarians. It could have been another student, of course. But as it turns out, Dottie liked that book so much that no one took it out but her. She had it constantly. I think many of the other students were used to having their own books and didn't use the library quite like Dottie did. I went a bit further. I looked at the police report about what was found in the dome and basement. A pencil was found on the floor of the liquor room. It had rolled off to the side of the room. It was dull. One of the student pencils. They're blue and have Ellingham Academy written on the side. So it's reasonable to conclude that Dottie made that mark, and made it that day in the dome. But why?
It could have been an accident,
George Marsh said.
She gets startled or someone grabs her. She accidentally slashes the page with a pencil.
No, I understand why you might think that, but no. An accidental mark wouldn't have been so precise. This was deliberately underlined.
I think Dottie Epstein was making an effort to send a message she was hoping I would understand. She was counting on me, and I let her down.
Albert,
George said.
You can't do this to yourself.
Albert Ellingham waved down this injunction.
I appreciate what you're trying to do, George, but it's true. I understood Dottie. She was someone who played the game. Her uncle was with the New York City police, actually, like you. She claimed that she learned many of the techniques for breaking into places from him.
Albert Ellingham chuckled a bit, and George Marsh smiled.
Yes,
Albert Ellingham said.
She was a very clever girl, Dottie, and she didn't go down without a fight. Oh, do me a favor. There's a panel under your seat. Reach down between your legs and slide it to the left. Have a look inside.
George Marsh bent down as instructed and slid the panel. Under his seat were tight bundles of dark sticks of explosive, firmly fastened to the body of the boat. Albert Ellingham looked right at the sun.
This boat is rigged,
he said calmly.
There's four more like that one. I've just set the trip wire and it is connected to the rope around my hand. If I release it, we will both go up. I could have used a gun, but it's too easy to get a gun away from someone, and I don't like guns. Frankly, I couldn't trust myself. My desire to shoot you is too strong. This requires me to have some self-control if I want to find out all I need to know. Your only option right now is to sit very still and tell me how it all happened.
24. Stevie sat on the concrete floor of the cupola, the cold seeping through the fabric of her jeans. Around her was a scatter of dried, dead flower petals. Many of the tributes were gone, but a stray card had escaped maintenance and their brooms and bags. It was a small piece of blue paper, the edges covered in a hand-glued rim of black glitter. The message on it was written in one of those fancy lettering styles that people who were really serious about their bullet journaling used. It read, "Never say dead. Never stay dead. Love forever. Melody." Stevie set the paper down. She had no proof, of course. She couldn't take it to court. She could not immediately write a book, not that she knew how to write a book. She had seen Nate trying to write a book, and the process looked terrible. She had never actually worked out what she would do once she solved the case. Who did she tell? Did she shout it at the moon? Tweet it? Update her Facebook status to crime solver? Which is why she needed to talk to Fenton. She stared at her phone. "Why aren't you ringing?" she said to it. The phone sat there, blank and unknowing. She picked it up and texted Hunter. What is your aunt doing? I need to talk to her right now. Can you tell her she needs to call me? She stared, waiting to see the message go from delivered to read. Nothing.
Breathe.
She got up and walked around in a circle, running her hands through her short hair, feeling the sides of her fingers slide up and lose the strands. What could she do with this thought she was having? How could she check her work? There was only one thing, of course. Do it like they did in the stories. Gather the suspects, run through the theory of the crime. Not physically, of course, in her mind. She would call down the dead, line them up, go point by point. Around the cupola, she set a ring of imaginary chairs. In two of them, she placed Edward Pierce Davenport and Frances Josephine Crane. Edward had his flashing, poetic good looks. Frances, her blunt, raven-colored bob. Frances was dressed in a chevroned twin set, a sweater and skirt. Tight, wool, brown and cream. And she wore a beret tilted sharply to the right. Edward was wearing a white shirt, a tie loose at his neck, and an open black vest. He leaned over his knees to look at Stevie, his eyes flashing, while Frances sat back, cool and considered.
You,
Stevie said to them in a low voice. There was no one in sight, and talking out loud helped.
You wanted to be outlaws.
We were outlaws, said Frances.
We wrote the poem, said Edward.
It's a stupid poem, Stevie replied. I've read your poems. You're a bad poet.
Edward drew back in offense.
Your stupid poem messed up the case for years, Stevie went on, circling the space. Everybody thought this was about truly devious. But there is no truly devious.
We were playing the game, Francis said. Like in the poem, the king was a joker who lived on a hill and he wanted to rule the game. So Frankie and Edward played a hand, and things were never the same.
But you wrote that before you left school, Stevie said, before it all went wrong. You had no idea what was coming. You had something else in mind.
Francis smiled quietly.
So you're in this, Stevie said, but you're not responsible.
No, you weren't the person who was never there, the one on a staircase but never on a stair.
You take the stare away. That's what he was saying.
Take the stare away and you have...
The figure of George Marsh materialized in the seat next to Francis. He was wearing a pinstriped suit and a fedora. He was a large man, strongly built, with a square jaw. He folded his arms and stared at Stevie, challenging her.
You've got nothing, he said. I'm in the FBI. I know when you have no case.
You're wrong, she said to him. You made a mistake. You were seen by someone who loves mysteries.
One more ghostly figure appeared in the circle. A girl, with curled hair and a gap between her teeth. She wore a plain brown wool dress and slightly crooked glasses. She clutched a book to her chest. She looked at George Marsh for a long moment, then turned to Stevie and nodded. Stevie nodded back. The dark forms of trees, the pillars of the cupola, the statues all stood in witness.
Gotcha, she said to him.
Her phone rang. The phantom circle vaporized into the night, leaving Stevie alone with the flower petals.
Are you coming back? Nate said. What are you doing?
You wouldn't believe me.
Try me.
I solved it.
A pause.
Where are you?
The cupola.
I'm coming over, he said.
Stevie lowered the phone from her ear and checked her messages again. Hunter had still not read the text. What the hell was Fenton doing? Not now. The kid is there. The kid is there. Sure, people said stuff when they were drunk, but that was so specific. So insistent. Suddenly, her brain was itching. Of course, people sometimes don't answer their phones. Sometimes people say strange things. But these were discordant notes. She looked at the cement she was standing on. The remains of Hayes's tribute crunched under her shoes. Ellie had been under them all along, all that time. They had walked over her. Had she heard them above? Heard her friends passing overhead as the air grew stale? As she shivered? As she starved and dehydrated? The fear must have been extreme, beyond anything Stevie would ever know. Did she realize she was dying down there in the dark? Did she make friends with that dark, with the thing that came for her in it? That insidious friend in the shadows who came to take her pain and fear away? Why was the phone so quiet?
He said to do it. He said whenever.
She clenched and unclenched her fists several times, then made the call. Larry answered on the second ring. Stevie could hear the television in the background and a barking dog.
What's wrong?
He said. I don't know, she said.
All right. Talk me through it.
I know who kidnapped Alice and Iris, she said. I know who killed Dottie.
What?
But that's not it, she said, her breath coming fast. That's not what's wrong. I think I'm worried about the professor I work with in Burlington, and I don't know why. Something's wrong. I feel it in my gut.
Give me her address,
Larry said. October 30th, 1938, 6 p.m. It had been quiet on the sailboat for some time. George Marsh and Albert Allingham sat looking at each other as the sky turned a volcanic red and orange. A sensational Vermont autumn sunset was beginning.
Be dark soon,
Albert Allingham said, breaking the silence.
Very peaceful out here at night.
The water lapped gently against the sailboat.
Albert. No, no,
Albert Allingham said.
It's too late for that, George. Carrying secrets is exhausting work. I know this from experience. The burden seems bearable at first, but as time goes on, it increases in weight. It pulls on you. Now it is time to put that burden down. Albert, you see,
Albert Allingham said, ignoring the interruption.
I picked the right girl in Dottie Epstein. She was one in a million. I'm not sure anyone else could have gotten the answer to me. I'm only sorry it took me so long, Dottie. I was slow. I let you down. But I finally got there.
He addressed this remark to the setting sun.
I think perhaps I figured it out on a subconscious level, George. You must know that feeling as a police officer. You know on a level you can't reach. It was clear someone inside the house had to be involved in the kidnapping. I had everyone investigated to within an inch of their lives. I found out about the cocaine that Leo had, that Iris was taking. I found out so many things about so many people that I didn't want to know. But I didn't find anything that explained what happened to Iris or Alice. The most obvious thing is the thing I missed. You really never do see the thing that's right in front of you. I wrote a little riddle to myself the other day. It went like this. Where do you look for someone who's never really there? Always on a staircase, but never on a stair. I sometimes come up with my riddles automatically. My mind generates them, and I have to solve them for myself. There are many things to try when solving riddles. Always on a staircase, but never on a stair. In this case, the riddle is telling you to remove the word stair from staircase. What word do you get? Tell me.
Case,
George Marsh said reluctantly.
Exactly. Who is always on a case? An investigator. Who is someone who is never really there? The guest who isn't a guest? The police officer. There to protect, never part of the crime. You were the person standing on that vanishing stair. Dottie told me. She told me in her own words. You see, when the students first arrived, I did some recordings of them talking about their experiences at the school. I was thinking of putting together a little reel to show before films.
Dottie said something very amusing. She said she had been frightened to come to the woods because she was from the city. Imagine that. For Dottie, the city was the safe space and nature was wild and frightening. But her uncle, the police officer, told her not to worry. He said there was an attic man at the school. I had no idea what she was talking about. So she explained that thieves are often called second-story men, and that the police were attic men who were on the floor above. They'd jump down and catch the second-story men. Her uncle knew who you were. George Marsh, the famous cop who saved Albert Ellingham. And so did Dottie.
Another boat came by at a distance, heading in for the night. Albert Ellingham raised his hand in greeting as if nothing was wrong.
I don't know it all,
Albert Ellingham said as he waved.
That's why we're here. I'm going to tell you what I've worked out, and then you'll fill in the rest. I know that on the afternoon of the kidnapping, you were in Burlington. You were seen at the post office, at the police station. You were all over Burlington when Iris took the car out. So you probably were not involved in the physical act of kidnapping, though I could be wrong. You must have come up to the house in the late afternoon. I imagine the fog helped. Not a lot of cars out, hard to see. There were no unusual tire patterns, so I suspect you parked where you always park. You didn't play around with anything silly, like wearing shoes that were too large and trying to leave fake prints. If any traces of you were around, well, so what? You were at my house all the time. You are the person who is always and never there. You went into the tunnel, you went up into the dome, and there you were, face to face with one of the brightest girls in New York City. You had some kind of weapon, I'm sure, but she had something greater. She had her book. She looked at you and she recognized the attic man. Maybe she knew her time was limited. She wasn't going to let you get away with it. Like the dying person in A Study in Scarlet, she left a message for me. This is where I need you to take over, George. Explain it to me.
There is nothing to explain,
George Marsh said.
Then we have nothing to talk about, and if we have nothing to talk about, then I suppose I'll...
He reached for the rope, and George Marsh leaned forward, his hand outstretched.
That can't be real,
George said, the bomb.
Oh, it's real. As is my promise to set it off if you don't tell me what I want to know.
Why would you?
Because I have nothing left,
Albert Ellingham said quietly.
The only thing I need is the answer. I know you have it. If you do not give it to me, then I will end us both. Think very carefully about what you will do next, George. Realize I did not get where I am in life by making idle threats.
Quiet can be deafening. The lapping of the water, the sound of a bird in the distance. Every flutter and every ripple boomed. George Marsh remained where he was, half lurching forward, sweat appearing on his forehead. He licked his lips and blinked several times. Then the air seemed to go out of him and he slowly fell back against his seat.
That's right,
Albert said, his voice gentle.
You see now. Set it down, George. Talk. Talk and feel the relief. Go ahead, son. We have all the time in the world.
It was the softness of tone that made George Marsh's eyes go red.
It was never supposed to happen the way it did,
he finally said.
That's what you need to understand. There was never supposed to be any violence. Never. It just went wrong. Why did you do it, George?
George Marsh knotted his hands together.
When I started running with you and your friends, I got in a little over my head. I played some cards. I'm good at cards. I was winning. And then, one day, I wound up in the hole for about 20 grand with some guys in New York, real heavies. They knew I was connected with you, so they let me keep betting. I thought I was going to win. Money?
Albert Ellingham said.
George, if you needed money, why didn't you come to me? To pay gambling debts?
George Marsh said.
If you needed help, I would have helped you. And then never worked with me again.
George Marsh said.
I needed to get myself out of this jam and never get back into it. And so you took my wife and child?
Albert Ellingham's voice was rising a bit. He cleared his throat and composed himself.
Go on,
he said.
One day,
George Marsh said, his head down.
I saw one of the kids from the school out reading one of those crime story magazines. I asked her about it, and she said she was reading one about a kidnapping. She wanted to know if I had ever worked on one. I said I had. She asked me if there were notes, trails of clues. The more she asked me, the more I realized that the kidnappings I had seen were simple. You take someone, you get paid, and you give them right back. As long as no one sees your face, the matter is largely settled. Then I thought about the money in the safe in your office. It all came to me. I'd ask for that money. Honestly, I thought Iris would... Would what?
George Marsh looked up from wringing his hands.
Enjoy it,
he said.
Enjoy it? She was looking for thrills, Albert. She was using cocaine, you know that. You know what kind of company she kept. She wanted fun and adventure. She was bored up here. All that was supposed to happen was that she would be grabbed and put in a barn for a few hours. You could see Iris telling that story over dinner.
If Albert Ellingham could picture this, he did not say so.
I got two guys I knew. Real two-bit hoodlums, no real brains. They'd steal anything, but they never hurt anybody. I offered them $2,000 apiece to help me out for a few hours. Their job was to block the road with their car. And when Iris went out driving, they were supposed to grab her, blindfold her, tie her up, and put her in a barn a few miles away. I would get the money. Then she would be freed. Maybe she'd have a scratch or two, but she'd be home, laughing. Home and laughing. But she is not home,
Albert said.
She is not laughing. No. No, she isn't.
George Marsh pulled the cigarette from behind his ear.
Alice was in the car. I think that... complicated things.
He faltered, but Ellingham waved him on.
I was in Burlington that day, like you said. We had a signal set up. I would have lunch at Henry's Diner, and when the thing was done, when Iris was, you know, with them, they would call the diner and ask for Paul Grady. The waitress yelled out for Paul Grady at 1:05. I paid my check and left, but I stayed in town for a while and kept an eye on where you and Mackenzie were working. Then I drove down Route 2 toward the house and parked by a phone booth. One of the guys was on lookout for when you left Burlington and called me. That was when I had to get into place. It was foggy, so no one was really around. I parked in the back and let myself into the tunnel. I was wrapped up in a scarf and coat and hat. All I had to do was wait in the dome, get the money from you, tie you up, and then drive back to the phone booth. I know someone at the telephone exchange. Margot,
Albert Ellingham said.
Margot Fields. This was the one element that always bothered me. We reached you at home that night, and you couldn't have gotten home in time if you were the person Dottie saw. I realized quickly just how simple it would be to have your call connected somewhere else, but Margot had spoken to the police. She said she put the call through to your house. I had to go back and ask her again, and finally she admitted that she put the call through to the phone booth. She said you told her not to say. It was part of FBI business. And that certain things had to be kept from both the public and me. So, you go to the dome, and instead of finding it empty, you find Dottie Epstein. What happened to Dottie? You've got to understand,
George Marsh said.
The thing had already started. We had to go through with it. I didn't want to hurt her. I didn't know what to do. She's just standing there, holding her book like a shield or something, telling me she won't say anything. And I'm standing there thinking, what do I do with this kid? I think I said, I can't let you leave, or something. And before I knew it, she jumped right into the open hole in the floor. I swear to you, she jumped. She jumped right down into that hole, trying to get away.
His voice splintered, and it took him several minutes to recover.
God, she must have hit her head so hard on the ground. That fall is, what, 10, 12 feet? I climbed down after her. There was so much blood. She was groaning and trying to crawl, but she couldn't make it. She was sliding. Her skull must have been cracked wide open. If I left her, it would have been worse. I swear, it would have been worse. I watched her sliding on that floor, and it was so horrible that I had my piece on me, but if I shot her, that would trace back to my gun. So I grabbed a pipe that was leaning against the wall. Some stick or something. You must use it to prop open the hatch. And I just hit her the once, and she stopped moving.
The sky began to properly darken.
I don't even know what my mind was doing at this point. It had all happened in seconds. I never wanted anything to happen to that kid. You were going to be coming soon. My only thought was, clear the scene. I put her in one of the liquor crates that was down there. It was full of wood chips for the bottles, so it soaked up some blood. I cleaned the floor with booze. I scrubbed my shoes with booze. I put the crate on one of the wheeled dollies, and I rolled her up. I got her into my car. Why didn't you leave her?
Albert Ellingham asked.
If there was no body, there'd be nothing to see. No crime scene. I could come back, clean it right later on. I had to clean it up. Then I went back up and took my place to meet you. I didn't mean to hit you like I did. I was so jazzed up because of the kid. I took the money, I went back out of the tunnel, and I got in my car and left. I went to a roadside diner. I'd started having dinner there for a few weeks, so they'd expect me. It was closer to your place than my house. I'd always tell everyone I ate before I got to your place because of all that French stuff you eat. Crème de ooh-la-la, when a guy just wants a burger. Everyone got a kick out of that. So I had a Salisbury steak and a coffee and waited for the call to come. I knew it would. That's what everything was banked on. If calls came in the evening and there was no answer at my house, Margot at the exchange would route my call there so I would seem to be at home. From there, I would wait for your call, which came. I would come to the house. I would be the one to go out and get Iris. When I got there, I'd give my guys their cut, and I'd bring Iris home. That was the plan. But that's not what happened.
No,
Albert Ellingham said.
It was not.
When I got there, I gave them the money. I was holding it together, but they were rattled too. Iris fought because of Alice. She struggled. And they weren't as stupid as I thought they were, or as harmless. They said that Ellinghams were worth a lot more than 2 grand each. I offered them 5. They both jumped me. I could have taken them under better circumstances, but one of them got me with a wrench. They said they were in charge now. They had moved Iris and Alice to another location and said they had another guy with them. And that guy was ready to shoot and kill them if things didn't go as they said. They gave me the drop-off instructions. The situation was out of control.
So you came to the drop-off the next night,
Ellingham said.
By that point, I'd had a chance to think,
George Marsh replied.
I had no idea what had happened to Iris and Alice, but I had to try to get them out of it. I would have done anything.
But you still took some of the marked bills from the pile,
Albert Ellingham said.
To cover yourself. To frame someone else. I had to show the guys I had something I could use to get them out of trouble. Something to make the whole thing go away. I always had a mark in mind. Voracek. He was trouble. We would all be glad to see him busted. He'd threatened you before. All I had to do was plant some of the money on him. I was going to tell the guys that they'd walk away with no problems. I waited for them to contact me. They never did.